Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Good evening and welcome to the latest Jeffrey B. Graham Perspectives on Ocean Science, August the 13th, 2007. My name is Nigella Hilgarth and I'm the Executive Director of the Birch Aquarium at Scripps. And it's great pleasure, gives me great pleasure this evening to introduce our speaker, Dr. Dan Lubin. Dan has served as an Associate Director of the California Space Institute at Scripps since 1999, and he received a Master's degree in Astronomy and Astrophysics from the University of Chicago in 1988, and a PhD in Geophysical Science from the University of Chicago in 1989. And with his colleagues, Dan made the first measurements of enhanced ultraviolet radiation under anthropogenic ozone depletion at Palmer Station in the Antarctic between August and December 1988. And he came to SIO in 1990 as a postgraduate researcher, and he specialized in remote satellite sensing of the Earth's polar regions. And he joined the SIO research team, the staff, in 1993, and since then he's been principal investigator at SIO for the Arctic and Antarctic Research Center here at since 1994. And so he's extremely well-equipped to tell us all the things that we want to know about how rapidly the poles are melting, whether those polar bears have got a hope, how the penguins are doing in Antarctica. So I'm really looking forward to his talk, Global Warming and the Polar Regions, Undeniable Signs of Human Impact.
Good evening. Thank you for coming. Today I'm going to give you a brief overview, or as compact an overview as I can, of the unmistakable signs of climate warming in the polar regions. And of course, the poles are very distinct regions, one from the other. The Arctic, of course, is a frozen ocean, at least for the time being, surrounded by land, and the Antarctic is a high frozen continent surrounded by the world's most dangerous ocean. Very, very different climate regimes. The Antarctic tends to be a lot colder, but we're going to see some common threads in the influences of human-induced climate warming on both of these polar regions. Both the Antarctic and the Arctic need their own talks, to tell you the truth. Tonight I'll just hit the highlights, but probably in a few months after I get back from some field work later this spring, I'll do an Arctic talk, and then maybe after that hit some more highlights of the Antarctic in separate talks, because they're really complex and need separate presentations. But I can give you some of the highlights tonight just to orient you, to help you understand what's in the news media and so forth. Even in the early days of climate modeling, it's been realized that there should be a polar amplification of climate warming. And the early climate models, even with their simplified physics, predicted that whereas the Earth's climate on the global average might warm 1 or 2 degrees with the typical increases in CO2, in the Arctic this might be 4 or 5 degrees. And this has been predicted with the standard traditional classical feedback mechanisms, which I'll describe, but now we know that there are even more complications related to meteorology and dynamical trends. And this is just one of many. This figure here is one of many papers on the surface observations of the climate warming in the Arctic that tends to be most pronounced during winter and spring, less so during summer. And this is just a report of the surface observations, which have long correlated with the climate model simulations. The other thing we've known for some time, we've been fortunate that back in 1978, NASA launched a microwave satellite, a microwave imager called the SMMR. And after that, the NOAA followed on with a program called the Special Sensor Microwave Imager. And these microwave imagers have been mapping sea ice continuously for more than 20 years. And we have a good record of how the sea ice throughout the Arctic has been thinning, both thinning and decreasing in area. And I'll talk a little bit about that as well. The IPCC 2007 just released a report, and this is a paper of which Richard Somerville here at Scripps was one of the authors. And he has shown the panel to look at is the bottom one here. This is a plot of the sea level trend in sea level rise. And what's worth noting here is beginning around 1993, where we had satellite altimetry measurements of sea level, the rise has increased slightly, and it actually is coincident with one of the worst case scenarios in the IPCC climate model simulations that are used to assess how our climate is predicted to respond over the next couple or next 100 years to various reductions or lack thereof in CO2 loading of the atmosphere. And what's worth noting here is that the sea level change is as high as the worst case scenario in these predictions. And 50% of this sea level rise is directly attributable to the loss of the ice caps and the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets. One word of caution here, this is only a 10-year trend. We can't extrapolate this out 100 years yet. We don't know if this is some sort of cycle yet, but it is consistent with the worst case scenario in climate model simulations. That 50% of the sea level rise that's attributable to the loss of the ice caps. This is a breakdown by another set of authors that that shows how much is attributable to glaciers and ice caps worldwide, and then Greenland versus Antarctica. These estimates vary. Some say that the Antarctic is a little more than Greenland, but we're seeing that the Antarctic and the Arctic are contributing quite a bit to sea level rise in the loss of the ice sheets. I'll say just a couple words before I move into the polar regions about climate modeling in general. Sometimes we climate researchers find ourselves in trouble just with the word model. The word model means many things to many people. To a psychologist or an economist, it might mean some simple construct written on the back of an envelope. But in climate research, a model is the most sophisticated theoretical construct possible, simulating the atmosphere, ocean, and land processes, and it's essentially limited by computer power. And the more powerful your computer, the more the greater your ability to simulate with more greater complexity the various processes we know occur in the atmosphere, ocean, and land, and also the cryosphere. And this is just a figure courtesy of Warren Washington at NCAR, where he shows the evolution of the climate models in sophistication just as essentially as a function of computer power. And we see that in the present day, we're able to not only just do atmospheric circulation and greenhouse gases, we've been able to do that for a couple decades now, but the sea ice models are becoming quite sophisticated. The models are now coupled to the ocean very well, and we're able to put more subtle effects in, such as the effects of aerosols on the climate system, and we're also coupling the climate models with the land. So these are becoming very, very sophisticated, and with each passing decade, they do a better job of simulating present-day climate, and then from there we have more defensible extrapolations to future climate change scenarios based on CO2 loading. And I'm going to talk a little about aerosols as the segment of this talk that features my own research, but I just wanted to make another point of emphasis here. This is a plot you've probably seen many times of the global average temperature trend since the beginning of since the Industrial Revolution went into full swing in the late 19th century. And some of you are very familiar that the observations show actually a leveling off in temperature from the 1940s to the 1960s, followed by the more steep rise in global average surface temperature. And for a couple decades, the climate models could not reproduce that. We know that if we just put in natural variability, illustrated by the blue curve here, then we don't get a warming at all. That also includes the changes that we know in solar variability. However, for a long time, we couldn't reproduce that plateau from the 1940s to the 1960s in global average temperature. And a lot of naysayers in this whole issue looked at that and said, hey, your models really don't reproduce what's going on in nature, so maybe it's just a theory we shouldn't pay too much attention to. But when we have the ability to put anthropogenic aerosol, basically industrial emissions, into the climate models, with that increase in sophistication, we have the ability to simulate the industrial loading of the atmosphere post-World War II, where there was an industrial boom. And when you put that in and the radiative properties of the aerosol in decreasing sunlight, then we see that the climate models, as indicated by the red line compared to the black line here, they reproduce very well that plateau, followed by the rise from the 1960s onward. So this is just an illustration that with each passing decade and increase in sophistication in these climate models, we become more confident in our explanation of the observations. And that's what makes these climate models one of the great tools. We observe things in nature, and now we can attribute them quite conclusively to human impact on the atmosphere. This is the classical mechanism, which has been known for many years, that brings about much of the polar amplification of climate warming. It's called the ice albedo feedback mechanism. At any given time, part of the Arctic is frozen, but if you manage to melt some of the snow or some of the ice, you will reduce the albedo, or the reflectance, the extent to which the surface reflects energy back to space. And as you reduce the albedo, the surface then absorbs more energy, which increases the rate of melting and accelerates the melting, further reducing the albedo and increasing the energy absorption. So you have a positive feedback leading to a decrease in sea ice cover and a warming of the local climate and the local surface air temperature. This has been occurring with some reliability. Every time we've put ice and snow into the climate models, they tend to reproduce this, and we know that that contributes to the warming in the Arctic to quite a great extent. And this is just an illustration from a field experiment I was on about 10 years ago called SHIBA, which was a Canadian icebreaker frozen into the Arctic for an entire year. And you can see in May, the sea ice cover looks very solid and quite reflective. We didn't stay on the ship the entire year. We flew back and forth on twin otters. And back in May of 2008, when I was there, or I'm sorry, 1998, when I was there, we were able to land these twin otters with ease on the ice floe right there and go aboard the ship. But by the time I left in June, you can see what's happening. The ice is starting to melt. We're starting to get melt ponds on the ice. And you can see how much less reflective that ice surface is. At that point, the ice runway was beginning to deteriorate. And I got off on the last flight that was even possible out of SHIBA before the people were kind of stuck there the whole summer with no way to get off the ship. Now, there are two types of ice we need to distinguish from to first order. What's called multi-year ice, or ice that remains consistently there in a pack from 1 year to the next, and that is what we see in the central Arctic. And then there's also marginal or first-year ice, and that's the ice that freezes and expands in aerial extent and contracts with changes of seasons. And what's important to note is that the satellite mapping instruments that I just described are capable of distinguishing the two, because they measure at several microwave frequencies, actually three for the SSMI, and with clever algorithms you can tell first-year ice from multi-year ice by the different emissivity of the surface types. And so the satellites have been able to distinguish the multi-year ice from the first-year ice and show that there's been a trend in decreasing area of the multi-year ice. So here, if you notice from 1988 through 2001 in this particular study, one of several excellent ones, we see a decrease in the aerial extent of the multi-year ice. That's the ice that's there from one season, from 1 year to the next, particularly north of Siberia and north of Alaska. And you can interpret the satellite remote sensing data further, and you can estimate the dates of melt onset and freeze onset. And here, this is done by these same authors for two decades, the 1970s through the 80s, or essentially the 1980s, and then the 1990s. And we see that the melt onset is fairly late, typically late May into June for most of the Arctic during the 80s, where it shifts back into mid to early May during the 90s. The freeze onset displays the opposite effect. It comes out a little later. The freeze onset occurs a little later during the 1990s versus the 80s. And so we have longer melt seasons in more recent years. We don't just rely on satellite remote sensing to do this work. There was a wonderful set of cruises during the 1990s called SciSex, where the U.S. Navy, with the winding down of the Cold War, began retiring a lot of their nuclear submarines that they didn't quite need anymore, that had been prowling around up there for decades. And they made some of these ships available to researchers, and the first cruise was so successful they had a follow-on series of cruises. Now, I was still kind of a young researcher at that time, and being an atmospheric scientist, I couldn't find a justification to go aboard these ships. My grantsmanship was not that well-honed at that point. I think I could pull it off now if this experiment was kept on going, but in any case, this was a wonderful set of experiments. In that they made some very robust transects of the Arctic Ocean, and because these ships had been prowling around there for decades, beginning with the Nautilus in 1958, there were data sets to compare to from decades previous. And what was derived from all this by Drew Rothrock et al. Was a series of trends in sea ice thickness that's consistently decreasing through the Arctic. So from the satellites and the in-situ observations from submarines, we know that the aerial extent of the multi-year ice is shrinking and the sea ice is becoming thinner. Now the climate models, going back to them, this is one of several excellent papers that are out recently. Just using the climate change scenarios put forth by IPCC and predicting the sea ice loss with the coupled sea ice and climate models. And what's quite frightening here is if we were to go about business as usual, this is a CO2 increase to 800 parts per million by 2100, the Arctic sea ice entirely disappears. A gradual level off in CO2, consistent with some effort at stabilizing emissions, we still lose about a third of it by 2100. So the Arctic is quite sensitive. And the observations that we're seeing of sea ice loss are unmistakably attributable to the CO2 loading of the atmosphere from industrial emissions. Not only the sea ice is being impacted, but also the great ice sheets themselves. This is more satellite remote sensing data of the melt season on the Greenland ice sheets. And this is quite straightforward to do with any kind of radar scatterometer. These scatterometers were initially developed to measure sea surface winds, but they've proven quite useful over ice sheets in that whenever you have a dry snowpack, the surface is quite reflective to a radar beam, but that radar pulse gets attenuated quite a bit when there's any liquid water in the snow. So there's a direct measure of the presence of melting snow and its aerial extent. And we see here four snapshots, years 1992 through 1999, showing an increase in the melting area of the Greenland ice sheet. And this is extending this work out to 2005, done by Connie Steffen at Colorado from another radar scatterometer, the QuickSCAT. And you can see how just between 1992 and 2005, the melt extent has doubled in area and is actually extended above the 2,000-meter elevation line. So quite a bit of loss in the Greenland ice sheet has been noted so far. So far I've just talked about the classical ice albedo feedback mechanism, but in the climate models we have a new perspective, and the climate models actually reproduce this effect. It's funny how many of the naysayers of climate warming will say, how do we know it's just not some natural cycle? And they say this as if we climate researchers don't know of any natural cycles and have never heard of them. We know of many, and we follow them, and we make sure that the models reproduce them. One very important one for the polar regions are called the annular modes, also known as the Arctic Oscillation or the Antarctic Oscillation. The same kind of natural cycle occurs in both polar regions. It's a kind of I don't want to get too much into the meteorological detail here, but you can think of the Arctic Oscillation as simply a seesaw in surface pressure between subpolar and polar latitudes, and this manifests itself in strengthening or weakening of the circumpolar westerlies from roughly 50 degrees north toward the pole. And this is a very complex mode in that it doesn't vary in some normal periodic way. It can switch sign very suddenly, monthly or annually. It's something we just observe and try to make sense of. And it's characterized by an index, basically a difference in sea level pressures between subarctic and Arctic latitudes. And when that index is negative, meaning roughly relatively high pressure over the polar regions, lower over lower latitudes, we have relatively weak westerlies and cold air spilling out further toward the south. When we have the high index, we have stronger westerlies, and those contain more cold air to the north, and they also allow warmer air to advect into the polar regions. And we have been moving throughout the past two decades into a period of high northern annular mode index, or high Arctic oscillation index. And you can see that in this graphic here, where our darker shading is where the northern annular mode index becomes more positive by one standard deviation than the long-term mean. This also happens in the southern in the southern hemisphere. There's a southern annular mode, very similar in definition and in behavior to the northern annular mode. And Gareth Marshall of the British Antarctic Survey has reproduced this from observations, and there is definitely a 30-year trend toward a positive index in the southern annular mode. So what does this do? In the northern hemisphere, the Arctic oscillation, as it shifts into a positive index, it changes the nature of the sea ice circulation in the Arctic Ocean. When the index is low, there's more clockwise recirculation in the Beaufort Gyre, and ice remains in the central Arctic and has a chance to grow thicker. When the index is in a high phase, then you reduce that recirculation and you have more ice transport out of the Fram Strait into the North Atlantic. So this is this natural cycle, this mode of variability. Well, how does this relate to global warming? Actually, there is a very real, albeit complex, relationship. There's a connection between the stratosphere and the troposphere. As you probably know, as the troposphere has been warming due to our greenhouse gas increases, just by radiative balance principles, that has to result in a cooling of the stratosphere. That's been known for some time. These fluctuations in this natural cycle of an annular mode, they're accompanied by changes in the strength of a polar jet stream called the polar night jet. And when we were in a high index of the annular mode, the polar night jet is quite strong, the stratosphere is colder, and the ozone layer is thinner. When that polar night jet is strong, you get a refraction of planetary waves back toward the equator. And planetary waves are waves that transport energy from lower latitudes to the polar regions and warm it. Conversely, when you weaken the polar night jet, you get planetary waves diverted back toward the pole and bringing energy and warming potential to the polar regions. So all that's happening, but we have to realize there is a connection to climate warming. Greenhouse gas warming cools the stratosphere as it warms the troposphere. And this strengthens the equator to pole temperature gradient, and the wintertime westerlies in the lower stratosphere are then strengthened. Planetary waves are refracted toward the tropics before they impact the polar night jet. And the result is that a climate warming caused by our greenhouse gas emissions tends to shift the annular modes into a high index. And that's what we've been seeing in both hemispheres, a shift toward a high index in the annular modes. And so that's a dynamical positive feedback from the greenhouse gas emissions, in addition to the ice albedo feedbacks that have been started by the greenhouse gas radiative properties themselves. And I'll come back to that a little bit. So when I talk about the Antarctic Peninsula, I'm going to get into another subtle effect, and that's the role of aerosols on the climate system. The Arctic is quite different than the Antarctic in one way, and the Arctic is polluted for half the year. During the winter time, the Arctic air mass becomes somewhat isolated in the strong westerlies, and in Russia and Europe and parts of Asia, there are a lot of factories and a lot of industrial emission quite far north, not so much in the U.S. and Canada, mostly in Europe, and these aerosol particles from this industrial activity get trapped in the Arctic atmosphere. And they stay there for about half a year. The visibility there is noticeably reduced, and the radiative balance of the Arctic is altered significantly. And we've known this for about 100 years. The famous explorer Nansen noticed that there was soot on the ice when he did his cruises way back at the end of the 19th century. This has various effects on the climate system. Jim Hansen at Goddard has recently been publishing papers showing that when this aerosol gets into the snow, it reduces the albedo somewhat, and then that enhances the ice albedo feedback just by enabling the snow to absorb more energy and melt more rapidly, and then hence the sea ice as well. So this is just a schematic showing the pollution sources and the transport pathways of the Arctic haze. This was known for quite a bit, it was known for quite some time, beginning in the 1950s during the Cold War, when the U.S. Navy was snooping around with reconnaissance flights all over the Arctic. Many pilots would come back and note and report that they could barely see anything. An atmospheric chemist by the name of Glenn Shaw up at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks, pioneered studies of Arctic haze and did some pioneering work in their chemistry and identified their sources with a high degree of accuracy. During the winter and into the spring, these aerosol particles are trapped in the Arctic, in the central Arctic, and they affect the climate. And then towards the late spring into the summer, they begin to be removed by precipitation. The Arctic is cloudy most of the time, and these clouds and the precipitation that is accelerated during summer tends to make these particles rain out. But they're there for a good part of the year, and they affect the climate. And some of the research I've been working on most recently is looking at some of the subtle effects of the Arctic haze on the climate of the region. And this is something you may have seen in some of the other talks on climate about aerosol direct and indirect effects. We all know that there's this thing called the Asian brown cloud and global dimming. That's a manifestation of direct aerosol effect, whereby aerosols, just by being there, they cut down the sunlight reaching the Earth's surface by tens of watts per square meter, much larger, in fact, than the radiative warming due to the greenhouse gas emissions. At the same time, they warm the lower atmosphere, alter the hydrological cycle. They create another complication to the entire climate problem. What can also happen is when aerosols get into the clouds, they change the microphysical properties of the clouds. Essentially, for a given amount of precipitable water vapor, they will manifest in more cloud condensation nuclei and then decrease the average size of the cloud particle. And that does two things. If you're at low latitudes, over where we live, if you introduce aerosols into a cloud and reduce the mean cloud particle size, you increase the reflectivity of the cloud. And so you help the cloud cool the climate system. It reflects more sunlight to space because its droplets are smaller on average. But in the Arctic, something else happens. In the Arctic, the radiation from the cloud, the terrestrial or long-wave radiation, is a larger portion of the energy balance up there. And so the long-wave radiative effects of changing this cloud particle size are actually more significant. And when you reduce the droplet size of the cloud particles, in principle, you should increase the emissivity of the cloud, increase the ability of the cloud to radiate back toward the Earth's surface. In effect, you should be able to enhance the ability of the cloud to warm the surface and in essence, add another source of warming to the Arctic climate. And there have been a number of theoretical studies on that, and the question is, can we actually observe it in nature? Just to define a few terms here, I mentioned emissivity. What is emissivity? So you're not lost. It's just a fundamental law that says that an object radiates a flux of electromagnetic radiation that's proportional roughly to the fourth power of its temperature. And the emissivity is a constant in front of that sigma T to the fourth, Stefan Boltzmann law. If the emissivity is 1, then the object is radiating as efficiently as possible. It's called a black body or an ideal radiator. Very thick clouds with a lot of water in them are effectively black body radiators. If the emissivity is less than 1, then it's called a gray body, and it's not radiating as efficiently as it can. That's true of the thinner clouds you find in the Arctic, and the emissivity varies with the size of the water or ice particles in the cloud and also with the amount of water that's in the cloud. This is an illustration as a function of wavelength, of the Earth's greenhouse effect. And this is the kind of thing we're going to measure to get at these subtle effects of aerosols in clouds. What this is a downwelling emission spectrum of the infrared radiation back radiated from the atmosphere to the Earth's surface. And this is actually measured in the Arctic. The light blue curve here shows what the emission from the atmosphere to the Earth's surface looks like under clear skies. And if you look at the wavelength 15 microns, you see a large maximum in that radiation. This is the carbon dioxide, the big carbon dioxide emission band. And when we're talking about increasing CO2 in the Earth's atmosphere, all we're really doing is making that band just a little bit wider, typically around here. But in this band, the atmosphere is entirely opaque, and it's radiating toward the Earth's surface essentially from the lower few meters of the atmosphere. And the surface temperature here was just around freezing. And as you can see here, I've plotted equivalent temperature curves as a function of wavelength. And you can see that in this carbon dioxide band, we're getting radiation essentially from the lower few meters of the atmosphere. Here's the water vapor emission band, and the thing is, it behaves similarly. This is where water vapor opacity is maximized. Here, this is the range of the atmosphere where a lot of infrared sensors, a lot of infrared goggles, night vision goggles work and so forth. It's called the window, and the atmosphere is quite transparent to radiation in the window, except for a little ozone emission feature here. Half of this is from stratospheric ozone, half of this energy is from ozone in the troposphere. This window is what's filled in by clouds. As clouds come along, they emit a lot more energy toward the Earth's surface, and they warm the climate system. And the instrument we use to measure this, I've worked with these instruments for many years. When I was a postdoc, I built one, not entirely from scratch, but put one together from commercial components. There's an excellent instrument deployed by the Department of Energy Atmospheric Radiation Measurement Program called the ARRI. And it's essentially a Michelson interferometer, an FTIR system that measures the terrestrial emission spectrum of the atmosphere. And the University of Wisconsin that's developed this instrument has done a fantastic job of making this thing very, very accurate, very precise. And these things have been deployed at several places around the world for 10 years now, and they're putting out a wealth of data into the exact detail of the greenhouse effect. U.S. Department of Energy's Atmospheric Radiation Measurement Program is one of these unique resources for climate research, and I've been very, very privileged to be supported by them for a number of years now. What they decided to do back in the late 1980s was to say, okay, climate models are wonderful, but why don't we actually try to measure what goes on in these climate model grid cells with the most advanced instrumentation possible, the kind of things we take on ships for a few months or take on aircraft field campaigns for a few months. Why don't we invest some money and put them there for years on end, essentially in perpetuity, as long as we can keep doing that. And they chose three sites to do that. One was in the middle of Oklahoma, and another is in the tropical western Pacific. And a third one that's of most interest to me is at the North Slope of Alaska. And they have a remarkable suite of very advanced meteorological and atmospheric radiation measurement instruments up there, and they've had that in there since 1998, and they now have we have a wealth of data on the Arctic climate system now from that. Going back to how we determine if there's an aerosol indirect effect affecting the clouds, from just radiative transfer theory, we can calculate how the emission spectrum should vary as we vary the liquid water content and the effective particle size or effective radius of the cloud droplets. And then we can see if the measurements of that match that. And here are two measurements expressed as brightness temperature from that ARRI instrument under very similar clouds, but one with high aerosol concentration and one with very clean air. And you notice that for very similar clouds, there's quite a difference in the spectrum throughout the middle infrared window. We can actually use these spectra to retrieve the cloud particle sizes, the average cloud particle sizes directly. But what's of interest for a statistical study is to know that, to see if this appears consistently in the data. And in fact, we see that it does. We see that under high CN, or high aerosol loading, the clouds are much more consistent with smaller effective droplet radius just by their spectral measurements. And that's something you really can't get out of a simple measurement. You need the spectroradiometer to distinguish this effect. And what is the size of this effect? If we co-locate these measurements where we use the spectroradiometer to determine where that indirect effect is happening, if we co-locate that with an independent measurement of the downwelling flux backrated from the atmosphere to the surface, we find that there's up to 8 watts per square meter more when the aerosols are present. And without going into too much detail, we can attribute 3.4 watts per square meter on a climatological average to the presence of the aerosols. And it's the pollution affecting clouds, making the droplets smaller. And this is comparable to the radiative effect of CO2 increase. So these pollution aerosols that are up in the Arctic from industrial activity are enhancing the warming of the Arctic during the winter and early spring by changing the size of the cloud particles such that they emit more radiation toward the surface. Okay, now I'll move on to the Antarctic. A couple of highlights from from the Antarctic. The big one is the Antarctic Peninsula. The Antarctic Peninsula is actually the largest warming we're seeing anywhere on Earth, the largest warming trend. And there have been a number of measurements and there are a number of studies, particularly by the British Antarctic Survey, that are shedding a lot of light on that. The British Antarctic program is essentially in the Antarctic Peninsula and the Weddell Sea region. I mentioned that there's a southern annular mode in addition to a northern annular mode. That the southern annular mode is doing two things. It's cooling part of the Antarctic continent, and it's allowing the Antarctic Peninsula to warm. As these westerlies become stronger and they shrink toward the pole, they isolate the air mass over the Antarctic continent such that the Antarctic continent, the high Antarctic plateau, cools to space more effectively, whereas warmer air tends to get advected from lower latitudes in the Antarctic Peninsula region. You may have seen in some newspapers that there have been reports of Antarctic cooling from the NASA satellites. This is by Joey Camiso at Goddard. And so how is global warming happening if the Antarctic is cooling? Well, the greenhouse gases are affecting the annular mode, putting it in a positive index, strengthening the westerlies, allowing the Antarctic continent to cool more effectively, whereas the Antarctic Peninsula warms because it's exposed more readily to warmer air from northern latitudes. And the most dramatic manifestation of that has been the breakup of the Larsen ice shelves, the A and B. Here's a sequence of satellite images courtesy of Ted Skambos. Some of this goes back to the 60s with some of the classified spacecraft. But we see the Larsen ice shelves steadily shrinking in area over the passing decades. Just another figure showing the temperature trends throughout the Antarctic Peninsula region, the largest warmings on Earth. These are in degrees per decade. This is larger than anywhere else on Earth. And you notice how far north the Larsen ice shelves are and have persisted until very recently. One thing that they noticed as they began to study the Larsen ice shelf, there's a lot of melt ponding on the ice shelf as the temperature warms. The Antarctic Peninsula is not all that cold, typically. It's a few tens of degrees below freezing during winter, but it's around freezing and a little warmer during spring and summer. And as you just get above the triple point of water, you get a lot of melt ponding on the ice. And what's happened has been a dramatic breakup of the Larsen ice shelf. This is an area. This area here is about the size of Rhode Island. And this is a sequence of only a few weeks, beginning in January of 2002, where I'll scroll through this. You'll see how quickly the entire Larsen B ice shelf broke up, just from one satellite image to the next. You begin to see a lot of calving, even more. Now you pretty much have icebergs instead of an ice shelf here. By March, only a few weeks later, the entire Larsen B ice shelf is gone. And this is what we attribute, this is the mechanism we attribute to it. When you get that melt ponding from the just a little bit of warming, just raising the ambient temperature above the triple point of water, you get melt ponding that increases the pressure in the crevasses within the ice, creating a lot of mechanical pressure, which then helps to break up the ice shelf. What we do know is when we correlate some of the temperature anomalies that are well above freezing, that correlates in time with the exact episodes of breakup that we know that we observe from satellite data from the Larsen ice shelf. Here's a record of the breakups as observed from satellite data, and if you notice the temperature, whenever it exceeds when it pops above freezing, that's where you notice a lot more of the breakups. And so this is how we attribute the breakup of the Larsen ice shelf to the peninsula warming. And that's helping to contribute towards sea level rise. Not only is the ice shelf breaking up, but the glaciers feeding the ice shelves are accelerating in the rate at which they discharge ice. And you can consistently see that upward trend in the flow speed of virtually all the glaciers that feed the Larsen ice shelf. And this is just one photograph of one of these things breaking off. This is Ted is right here. It's a small iceberg for the Antarctic, a massive tabular berg. Recently, Maria Vernet here at Scripps published in Nature on the ecology of these large icebergs as they break off the Larsen ice shelf, drift north, and then get caught in the circumpolar gyre around Antarctica. They become sort of an oasis for
a wide variety of marine life.
I don't have any stories about the polar bears yet, but I do about the penguins. In the Antarctic Peninsula region, we're seeing dramatic shifts in penguin populations, and this is work that Bill Fraser has been doing for decades on the Antarctic Peninsula. There are three common species of penguins on the Antarctic Peninsula, the Adelies, the Gentoos, and the Chinstraps. The Adelies are true Antarctic penguins in that they overwinter on the ice and they make their habitats a little further north where they form rookeries and hatch their chicks. Now, these birds are not the brightest birds in the world. They tend to nest always in the same place every year. Once a young bird decides where it's going to put its nest, it will always go back to that same spot within a couple of meters, year after year after year, throughout its life, and it will try to hatch eggs there. And if the climate changes to make that nesting area unsuitable, the bird just doesn't know any better and it keeps trying. And what's been happening as the peninsula's been warming, there's been a lot more precipitation on many of these islands, particularly around Palmer Station and throughout the Antarctic Peninsula. A lot more precipitation, meaning a lot more snow cover in the areas where these birds have been nesting. And the snow cover essentially makes the nesting habitats non-viable for hatching birds. And you can see here, this poor bird is just trying to, he's come back to his same place every year and he's trying to hatch an egg. He's trying to incubate an egg right there where there's snow cover, and it's not working very well. Not only that, but as the sea ice has been retreating in the Western Antarctic Peninsula region, these birds overwinter on the sea ice and they need to forage from the sea ice when they're trying to survive in the winter, and as that ice retreats, they can't forage as well because of the darkness. And that also impacts the viability of these colonies. Another thing that's been going on, as the sea ice has been retreating, elephant seals have been just taking up space. These things, they don't really harm the penguins, they just kind of come and take up space and push them out of the way. And we know that that's been infecting the viability of the colonies too. So what's been happening over the years is the colonies have just been failing to reproduce. This is a colony that's sort of in decline, and these five birds here are the remains of a colony that had been there for many years, but these birds just keep trying to come back and nest in the same place, and they just can't hatch the eggs as the climate changes. Here's some more sort of pathetic pictures. Here's a bird that's just basically under the snow. He's there trying to incubate an egg. He doesn't know any better to try to move. Here's some more birds just doing the same thing. And we've been seeing for decades now Adelie penguin colonies in quite dramatic decline on the peninsula due to the climate change and the increased precipitation over many of the islands there where the rookeries are. And these are the invaders. These are the Gentoos and the Chinstraps are sub-Antarctic penguins. They overwinter further north, and they're a lot more adaptable to this changing environment, and they've been taking over some of the areas that have been vacated by the dwindling Adelie colonies. And this is just a graph, essentially a lot of Bill Fraser's work over the years, showing the breeding population of the Adelies just in steady decline with the Antarctic warming trend, and the invaders, the Gentoo and the Chinstraps, taking advantage of that and colonizing what the Adelies are leaving behind. So just to summarize things, only had time to hit a few highlights here. Both the Arctic and the Antarctic are impacted directly by CO2 increases in the atmosphere. Human influences in the Arctic, we get direct modification of the greenhouse effect by CO2 increases, and we get this ice albedo feedback and a cloud radiation feedback as well, whereas a warmer atmosphere holds, whereby a warmer atmosphere holds more water vapor, and there's thicker cloud cover and greater warming. We also have this alteration of the Arctic Oscillation, strengthening it, allowing more warm air to advect from lower latitudes into the Arctic, kind of feeding back on the warming and also helping to take sea ice out of the Arctic Ocean. Then finally, some of the work that I've done recently shows how industrial pollution aerosol alters the radiative properties of the Arctic clouds, increasing the thermal radiation to the surface comparable level to the greenhouse gas increases, and that's an additional warming of the Arctic climate system. On the Antarctic, we're not seeing so much of the ice albedo feedback because the Antarctic is a little more dynamic, or actually a lot more dynamic in many ways. But we are seeing changes in the annular modes that are attributable not only to the greenhouse warming, but also to the ozone hole, the dramatic stratospheric ozone loss over the Antarctic. And these changes in the annular mode index are essentially cooling the climate over the Antarctic continent and warming the climate over the Antarctic Peninsula. And the Antarctic Peninsula is the world's largest. And we're seeing ecological effects from that directly in the seabird colonies. And those are the highlights. I'll take any questions now. And I'll come back in a few months with some new data from a field program. And I'll talk about the Arctic and the Antarctic separately and give you a little bit more detail. But for now, hopefully this has been useful to you at this point. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.